Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Military History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jessica Maloney, and with us today is author and historian Donald Meller, who will be talking with us about his new book, Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy, which was published in October of 2019. Donald, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, where did you attend school, what drew you to the study of history?
I was born in Bray, Pennsylvania. It's on the North Board. It's in northeastern Pennsylvania, coal and industrial town and steel town. Grew up in a working class neighborhood. Wasn't too interested in going to college. Eventually, sports drew me there and went to a small college in western Pennsylvania called St. Vincent College. Great school, changed my life. Went on to grad school and did some work at Yale and graduated from the University of Maryland with a PhD and then went into teaching after a brief stint at the Washington Post. And I've been involved in academic teaching at a number of institutions, Cornell and Penn, and now I'm at Lafayette College and I've been here for a while and I just retired last year.
Oh, that's...
And too much other work, films and books, and it was piling up and the teaching was kind of, not getting in the way, but it was a little too much.
Sure.
So that's where I am now. I just finished the book you mentioned. It's my 10th book. I should say this, I'm not trained as a military historian. Never took a military history course in college or graduate school. I became interested in it late in life. Not till of the 10 books I've done, I didn't do a military history till the sixth book, and that was a big book on World War II, and then I did a book on two aspects of World War II, one called D-Days in the Pacific, which was about the gigantic and savage Pacific War, and we did some films on that with PBS and with Anson Spielberg, and a 10-part show called The Pacific. And then I did a book on the bomber war over Germany called Masters of the Air. And Apple TV is now doing that. Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are the producers. We originally started with HBO and now have moved it over to Apple. And we should start producing, we will start producing this year. And we're hiring actors and whatnot. And it's going to be 8 to 10 hours. It's a dramatic series, not a documentary. And I'm also working on a couple of documentaries right now. So that's about it. I divide my time between, most of my time is devoted strictly, sheerly to writing. Get up every day, hit the desk, write through, and then either, golf, play tennis, take a swim, and clear the head and do some light reading. I read a lot of novels in the evening and go at it again the next day. It's relentless, like Grant's march to Vicksburg. it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
I love it.
Sounds like you got some exciting stuff ahead of you there.
Yeah. I'm doing a National Geographic show on Chicago, and we just did a documentary that's coming out. Just came out with Smithsonian on the Memphis Belle famous plane that was the first big bomber to complete 25 missions in World War II, and some other projects as well. So, and I've already started my next book, which is going to be about the end of the war and Grant, the partnership between Lincoln and Grant that brought the war to a close. So it deals with about 10 months of the war, the last 10 months of the war.
Great.
Focusing on the president and the commander-in-chief. It was a partnership unlike any in military history, very close. And so I just moved right on.
Right. So what would you say interested you about to write a book about Grant and Vicksburg?
Well, you know, I didn't come very, didn't become interested in the Civil War until the 1990s. And I think what provoked me was Ken Burns' documentary, a fantastic documentary he did on the war. But I was curious why he dealt so thinly with Vicksburg, which even in my elementary understanding was a gigantic and an immensely important battle. I've done some work with Ken, and I asked him, and he said, well, you need images to carry a documentary film, and he wasn't finding the kind of images he could find for, say, Gettysburg. So I started reading on Vicksburg, went down there, and, I thought the battle deserved a new look. There had been books pushed on Vicksburg, and I wanted to do a different kind of book.
Right. So you start the book at Cairo. Can you talk a little bit more about why you started there?
Well, that goes to the last question, actually. I wanted to write, I'll call it, Jess, a new kind of military history that is, I guess you could call it, a holistic approach. I don't want to do histories, and all my World War II books are like this as well, that just deal bullet by bullet with the conflict. Sheerly dealing with combat, say. I try to cast the war in a wider frame. I deal with, for example, at Vicksburg, I start with Cairo. And why start there? That's in 1861. Well, you see the emergence of Grant there. He takes over this godforsaken little community in southern Illinois at the confluence of the Ohio River and the Mississippi and turns it into a staging area for a gigantic military operation that lasted 3 years, and that is to conquer the entire Mississippi Valley, not just Vicksburg. And so I had to widen my focus. I wanted to deal with the evolution of Grant as a leader. Certainly wasn't capable of taking Vicksburg in 1861. I mean, he just re-enters military service. He had been drummed out of the service years before for drinking on duty. He was a failure in just about everything he tried after that. And he was shelving hardware, and leather goods at his father's store in a little town in western Illinois called Galena. And the war comes, and he has a local sponsor who puts him up for generalship, and he reads at the paper that he's appointed a brigadier general. Grant, you see, at Cairo is an evolving thing, and he's not the commander that's capable yet of taking a place like Vicksburg. Nor is Vicksburg the most important spot in the Mississippi Valley at that point. The South built a number. See, when the war starts, I mean, this becomes, below Cairo, the Mississippi becomes a rebel river. It's controlled by the Confederacy, and they surely expected that the Union would try to reconquer it. It was inevitable they tried. And they built a series of forts along the river and just inland to prevent the Yankees from penetrating. These forts extended all the way down to New Orleans. And Grant begins that process of reconquest. And as he knocks off one place after another and finally gets to Memphis, then Vicksburg pops up, because at that point, in late 1862, December 1862, New Orleans has already been captured by naval forces that, independent of Grant, come up through the Gulf of Mexico and in what was supposed to be a surprise attack, very difficult straits below New Orleans and captured the city without firing a shot. The Navy proceeded upriver, took Natchez, took Baton Rouge, again without much resistance at all. But Vicksburg refuses to surrender. And so in late 1862, back to that, it still hasn't surrendered. And it's a rebel river from Vicksburg all the way down to near Baton Rouge. And so the Yankees can't use it for military operations. And farmers from the Midwest can't ship their product, which they've done for years, down the Mississippi. And so this causes a lot of political agitation in the Midwest. Lincoln's losing votes out there. He has to open the river for that reason. He has to open up for military reasons. A lot of people thought the war was going to be won not in the East, at places like Antietam and Gettysburg, but it would be won in the West. So I shift the focus, in other words, in the war to for Burns, for example, in his film, it's predominantly on the Eastern theater. And I thought the Western theater and the West is where really the war was won, where the Confederacy was broken. There's still two more years of fight. Vicksburg surrenders, and get a little ahead in here, but Vicksburg surrenders on July 4th, 1863. It's the same day that the Union armies at Gettysburg hold off Lee and Lee gets to retreat to Virginia. So Gettysburg and Vicksburg are two signal victories, a turning point in the war. Maybe we can talk a little bit later about why Vicksburg becomes that turning point so early in the war. That's where it starts. It starts at Cairo, on this modest little community that becomes the largest military station in the West. All the gunboats, ironclad gunboats, were first developed in that area, in little towns, to the east and west of Cairo. Navy has its what's called the Brownwater Navy, the River Navy, which plays a huge part in my book, because Grant was a river warrior. That's how he moved his troops by water. And he couldn't have taken Vicksburg, for example, without the help of the Navy. And a man by the name of David Dixon Porter, who's a rear admiral, not a rear admiral, excellent. And that's kind of where everything begins. And the wounded were taken back. Confederate prisoners were taken back to Cairo. There were immense hospitals there. So it's a great centering point for understanding the war in the West.
Right. Okay. So then the book turns back to Grant and his early years and his career before the war and his struggles with alcohol. I really enjoyed the way that you explained his early years. How do you think the struggles that he had affected his actions in the war?
Well, that's a great question. And it's a real live issue in Grant historiography. A lot of historians have gone at this. And I think I have some new things to say. I mean, it's clear to me that that Grant, from a very early age, beginning with his service in the 1840s in Mexico, in the Mexican War, had a drinking problem. And he drank sporadically. He wasn't a continuous drinker. There's no question he was an alcoholic. He couldn't stay away from it. Difficult struggle. He did for long periods of time. I mean, one of the great battles of the book is Grant's personal battle with the bottle. And his problem was he couldn't handle his booze. Two or three drinks would set him off, sometimes crazily. And so generally when he doesn't drink when the fighting's going on, he doesn't drink on the battlefield. There's no evidence that he drank when with his family around, especially when his wife was around. But there's a lot of drinking going on in the Civil War. There's a book still to be written about drinking in the Civil War, and cocaine was especially almost epidemic proportions at Cairo. And Grant partook, and he drank right throughout the war. Again, he would drink on a Tuesday, and then he wouldn't drink for 3 weeks. And this is how it went. And for long periods of his life after the war, he licked the problem. And
And why do you think other treatments of Grant might have avoided talking about his drinking problem?
You know, that's a crazy thing. I think there's almost a kind of a stereotypistic view of Grant, you know, that you read this liquor thing into the biography. I mean, if you introduced it, you know, it diminishes Grant. I think it, you know, enhances Grant. He becomes more complex. He becomes real, you know. He's somebody you can empathize with. He has a problem and he's trying to lick it. And for long periods of times, he does just that. And I think it humanizes Grant. Other scholars don't just want to run away from it. There was one episode, for example, during the Battle of Vicksburg, where he was his army was being threatened. And I won't go into all the specifics, but we can come back to that. It was in a threatened situation. He's besieging Vicksburg. But there's another army behind him in a town called Jackson, about 40 miles away. And it's commanded by a general that Grant respected, Joseph Johnston, and who would fight Sherman at the end of the war in the last battles of Eastern Theater. And Grant felt that Johnston was about to move on his rear. He's facing Vicksburg and Johnston, you know, on his back. And so he went out to check out the situation out near where Johnson was supposed to be stationed on a river called the Yazoo River. And there's sense that he drank, well, he went on a bender on the boat and, and had to be put to bed, woke up the next morning and, he thought he was in a town called Satarsha, which is where he was headed. But the boat turned around and brought him back to where he started. There were witnesses on the boat, you know, one, a close associate of Grant named Charles Dana, who changed the story a couple of times, you know. And first he said Grant got roaring drunk, and then, you know, he trimmed that a little bit. And there was a reporter there named Cadwallader, and he has a very vivid account of Grant's drinking escapade, which was crazy. He got on a horse, he rode to the Indian camps. He fell off the horse, had to take it back in what was called an ambulance wagon, back to his encampment, et cetera. And for years, nobody believed it. But I found some pretty compelling evidence that supports Cadwallader's account. But and it also, you know, is disruptive, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, it contradicts a lot of the scholarship that said Grant never drank when he was in an imperiled situation. Now, he doesn't drink on the battlefield, but Vicksburg, this is probably the most anxious Grant had been in the whole campaign. He's really worried about Johnson. So his army was in peril, and he did drink when he shouldn't have been drinking. And so I think, you know, probably a lot of historians don't want to believe Cadwallader, but I find him a pretty compelling witness. As do some Grant biographers like William McFeely, who won a Pulitzer Prize for a book on Grant. A very good biography. I think McFeely makes an interesting comment that, you know, there's too much evidence to discount this. Much too much evidence.
Definitely seems like an underexplored area of Grant's life.
Yeah, and you find things like people said Cadwallader wasn't even on the boat. And what I found, and, you know, at the Chicago Public Library, is I found, you know, Cadwallader worked for a Chicago newspaper. I found a dispatch that was filed, a newspaper story that was filed from Satarsha on the very day that boat was in Satarsha. Now, who else, you know, would have been a Chicago reporter in Satarsha except Cadwallader? He's there. There's no question about it. So that at least is one of the indisputable facts. The other stuff is up for grabs. There's a lot of controversy about it.
Right. So the action in the book then moves to Fort Donelson. What do you think was the most important factor in the success there?
Well, you know, here Grant is. I mean, he moves out from Cairo, and he's going to use the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers, which run north and dump out into the Ohio. And the Confederates have built forts along the Cumberland and Tennessee, Fort Henry and Donelson. And working with the Navy, with naval gunboats, he takes rather easily Fort Henry, and then moved through the woods to a place called Fort Donelson. And it's a tough winter fight. Grant makes a big mistake there. He leaves the battlefield. He had to leave the battlefield. The naval commander at the time was injured and wanted to. He couldn't communicate with Grant any other way but having Grant come to him. And he was going to inform Grant that he's pulling his gunboats out. And so Grant went to see him. But he didn't leave anybody in charge of his army. And the Confederates broke out of Fort Donelson, which the Yankees were besieging, and almost overran the Union Army and escaped. And Grant returns to the battlefield while this chaos is going on and regroups. He's very good, Grant, making impetuous often, but he makes quick decisions, and he's very decisive on the battlefield, and he was there at Donelson. And he turns this ugly situation around within an hour and a half. And the momentum swings to the Union side, and they almost take the fort that night and took its surrender the next morning. So he performed brilliantly on the battlefield, but he did make mistakes, and he would continue to make mistakes in these early battles. As well as at Vicksburg. And again, I think this humanizes. I mean, this doesn't it doesn't diminish what he's doing. I mean, with this immense job he's given, conquering huge swaths of southern territory all the way down to Vicksburg. He's a young man, and he's gonna make a lot of mistakes. He'd only been a quartermaster in Mexico. He saw a little combat, but he had no real command experience before that. It's amazing. I mean, you consider a guy, what a great character for a book. I mean, if you wrote a novel and you created this guy, who the hell would believe it, He's shelving goods in a hardware store, a washed-up Army veteran in 1861, and that year he becomes a brigadier general. And the next year, he takes Donelson. It's unconditional surrender. And he becomes the first hero of the war because Donelson is the first Union victory of the war. You're right to point that out. And then Grant goes down the next year and takes Vicksburg. The next year, after taking Chattanooga, Lincoln calls him back east, and he's put in charge of all Union armies. And he goes to battle with R. E. Lee. And the next year, he takes Lee's surrender at Appomattox. And 4 years later, he's president of the United States. So in 8 years, he moves from a hardware store to the White House. I mean,
it's definitely a meteoric rise.
Yeah, it's meteoric. It's pretty amazing. It's a great character to wrap a book around. Yeah.
That leads me to my next question. The next part of the book, you talk about Shiloh and how both Grant and Sherman made a number of errors, but the Union still managed to eke out a victory there.
They go down the Tennessee River, they go down to Shiloh, a Pittsburgh landing it was called. It was a steamboat landing. But the Confederates were in a place called Corinth, which is like right down the road, about 12 miles. And there's a gigantic army forming there to reverse what Grant had taken from the Confederates at Donelson. When he took Donelson, he took great parts of Kentucky and Tennessee, so the South wants to regain them. They're mobilizing this tremendous army there under some of their very best generals. It's an all-star cast. And Grant sets up his encampment. And that encampment, it's a large army, and over 40,000. And it's vulnerable because Grant doesn't have the troops entrenched, and dig trenches and dig what were called earthen forts, defensive installations that would become more and more prominent as the war wore on. And he's right where the road to Corinth, begins. And he's going to march down that road to Corinth. He expects to and take it. But the rebels surprised him and Sherman, who was his, right-hand man this is the first time they fought together at Shiloh, and they get surprised. and they get rolled back almost to the banks of the Tennessee River. And the aim of the Confederates was to drive them back across the Tennessee River. And most of that day, it looks like a Confederate victory. But Grant sets up defensive line, and stubbornly, tenaciously, those are two of his key characteristics, he holds that line and makes a famous comment when Sherman saw him that evening, standing against a tree with a cigar in his mouth and a lantern in his hand and pouring down rain. He said, what are you going to do? And he said, lick them tomorrow. They got reinforcements, and he did just that. He rallies from that, but his reputation suffered. He was demoted after that. And in Army terms, arrested for a time. I mean, he was detained. He wasn't permitted to involve himself in military operations. And again, he comes back from that and is installed as commander of most of the Union armies in Tennessee. And that November 1862, after Shiloh, Shiloh's in April, he moves on Vicksburg. And he invades it from the north, from the Tennessee-Mississippi border. And tries to follow a rail line down into Mississippi and cut across and take Vicksburg by land from its rear. Vicksburg was most feared for its riverfront fortifications, its batteries, its cannons. And it was believed to be, by this time, but a lot of people thought, certainly some Confederates, that it was impregnable. So Grant's going to try to take it from the rear. And he failed. And makes a lot of mistakes because his supply line is a railroad that runs Confederate territory. And Confederate cavalry, led by Nathan Clifford Forrest and a guy by the name of Van Dorn, they cut his supply line. He's reached the university town of Oxford, and he has to turn around and retreat. But sends Sherman, who's going, you know, his army is with him. He sends in Sherman to Memphis, and Sherman goes down the river with 40,000 guys and tries to take Vicksburg from the Yazoo River. I don't want to get too complicated here, but that's a small tributary of the Mississippi just above Vicksburg. But when you go through that Yazoo River and its swamps, you face these things called the Walnut Hills, which, you know, it's like a castle wall protecting the north face of Vicksburg. He tries to attack those fortifications, and the Confederates are outnumbered, but they're dug in well, good lines of sight. And this is Christmas of 1862, and Sherman's army is slaughtered. And there's no other word for it. And they pull out. And, of course, Grant's, you know, got his tail between his legs. He's retreating from Mississippi. And he eventually goes down to Vicksburg. Sherman remains, you know, there, not in Vicksburg, obviously, which, you know, no Yankee boot had set foot in at this point. But Sherman's in Louisiana, right across the river. The Mississippi River from Vicksburg, and Sherman joins up with Grant. I should say Grant over Sherman, and they begin then that long, you know, test to try to take Vicksburg, which will last from January to July.
So Grant doesn't actually come across as any great military strategist in this whole situation here. You mentioned before it was really more about his ability to make quick decisions. When faced with failure, as opposed to him being any kind of brilliant military genius.
Yeah, he's a master of improvisation. Flexibility is his keynote. That got him in a lot of trouble later in the war when he took over by the sluggish Army of the Potomac that had been suffering a lot of defeats with some victories in the East, but it was an army that had a very formalized command structure. A lot of drill, parade ground stuff, officers dressed in dress uniforms with swords and things like that. Grant had a ragtag army, and, they marched into your town, you'd run up in the attic, you know. I mean, it's all these guys, long hair, they're woodsmen, they're western farmers, they're not all detailed. detailed, you know, in crispy military uniforms, wears a private blouse, you know, most of the time, mud splattered boots. But the Army was together. I mean, they had a sense of cohesion, and they believed in their commander. And Grant was, you know, Grant's a brilliant writer. I mean, his memoir that he wrote just before his death, finished it days before his death, and is one of the great pieces of American literature of the 19th century. And but he, during the war, he wrote these tremendously clear. He wrote this kind of Hemingway-esque diamond hard prose, and you couldn't help but understand what an order meant, where he wanted you to be, at what point in the battle he wanted you to attack. And he wrote these on the fly, you know, often on, you know, from the back of a horse while a campaign's leading. And they're so clear. And so, you know, he's an easy commander to, you know, to understand. And he expected a lot of his subordinates, too, and delegated a lot of responsibility to his commanders. He'd lay out the overall strategy, but you made a great point. He's not a master strategist. He doesn't read the great military treatises of the time. At West Point, they were required reading almost, and he couldn't bother with them. He loved to read novels, he loved to ride horses, and he loved to draw and do some watercolors, and wanted to be a university small college president. Or I should say, that's a little ambitious, but at the time he's about, you know, becoming a professor of mathematics at a liberal arts college. Imagine if he'd done that, where would we be without Grant in the war? But yeah, it's not blueprints. He'll lay out an overall plan and leave the details to the battle, because as he pointed out, like when he's fighting General Lee in the East, or when he's fighting this guy Pemberton, the commander of Vicksburg, who, by the way, was from Philadelphia, of all places. But when he fights, he says, well, I'm not going to plan a strategy unless I know what they're doing. I'm going to be reacting to their movements. And so it's going to call for a lot of on-the-spot thinking and rethinking. And so he doesn't have a scripted-out plan for a battle. And that was his genius, actually, to be in the middle of a battle and have the cool perspective to be able to assess where we're weak, where we're strong, are we getting beaten back? If we are, how do we turn this around? The mind's moving all the time. Grant's not a genius, I don't want to use that word, but he has a brilliant military mind. War makes Ulysses Grant. I mean, it threw him back into a position of high respectability from the grocery store to, you know, generalship in the Army. War made him a national hero, made him a president. And that's where he was at his best.
Moving on to the next section, is where you talk about the Navy and their struggle on the Mississippi. This section, I think, best illustrates that the fight for Vicksburg wasn't just fought on land by Grant and his army. The Navy obviously played a vital role in the victory.
He cooperates in eventually taking Vicksburg. From the time he arrives in these camps in Louisiana, the really rough winters are tough, can be very tough in Mississippi. Troops camped in some horrible conditions, swamps, just across the river from Vicksburg. They could see Vicksburg. But the water's undrinkable, most of it. Disease spread through the army and became rampant. Every kind of disease, from typhoid to malaria to dysentery, you name it, they had it. And you know, his troops are dying like flies. In fact, and the river is at a high tide at that point, and it's flooding the camps, and there's no place to pitch a tent. The Yankee soldiers had to almost lived the day out on the levees, on these high wooden, blocking, these levees that block the overflow of the river. And when Mary Livermore, a woman from Chicago who worked for called the Sanitary Society, which delivered medicine and all vegetables, fresh fruit, and letters, and brought these down regularly to Vicksburg. When she was approaching Vicksburg, her first sight of Vicksburg said it was coffins floating in the river. What would happen is the river would break through the levee, and the guys had nowhere to bury their comrades except on the high ground of the levee, so they slept close to the dead there. And when the water broke through, the coffins, and sometimes coffins of graves, the bodies and the coffins were thrust into the river, and that's the sight we saw when she arrived there. So it's amazing Grant recovers from that. But what he has to do is figure out a way to get past Vicksburg, below Vicksburg, where there's dry ground. If I can sketch a little geography here, if you go north of Vicksburg, north of the Yazoo River, there's this gigantic swamp, if you will, called the Yazoo Delta. It's one of the great cotton-growing areas of the South, but it's flooded a lot of the year. And it has almost no roads, and its rivers are almost impassable. So he was told, at least when he got there, that you can't go in that delta. You can't take Vicksburg from the north. You can't take it straight on from Louisiana because you're running right into those batteries, and there's no place to land. The town was located right on the river itself, and the town rises up rather steeply. It's a hill town. And the Confederates would have had a huge advantage. It would have been suicidal to hit it that way. So the only way you can get at this place is what Grant had tried before, to get in behind it. But to do that from Louisiana, you've got to march an army all the way down to a point south of Vicksburg and cross the river below Vicksburg into Mississippi and attack it from that side. And that's eventually what he did, but he couldn't do it for a long time because that country south of his camps in Louisiana was flooded. The entire towns were underwater. So he's really in a predicament. And he needs the Navy, as you point out, to help him out to move his armies. But wherever his armies are moving around Vicksburg, throughout the entire campaign, until he gets to Mississippi, they're moved on troop ships and with the protection of ironclad gunboats and commanded by Admiral Porter. And Grant actually does, with Navy cooperation, do what everybody thought was impossible. Actually, it turned out to be impossible. He went into the Yazoo Delta on three occasions and tried to get to Vicksburg that way. I won't go into all the expeditions, but I'll tell you how precarious it was, and it set Lincoln on edge when he learned that Grant was fooling around in those swamps. He goes up he didn't have any maps, by the way, in these forested areas that are flooded, trees overhang these narrow streams. They create a kind of canopy. It cuts out the sunlight. It's very dark and gloomy. All kinds of forest creatures. The Confederates are tracking him as he's going through there. And he's got his best gunboats. Five of them. He needs them to take Vicksburg. And he's got Porter, the guy he really needed, commanding the gunboats. And he's got his number two guy, Sherman, commanding the troops. So he's risking Sherman, Porter, and the gunboats to go on this unbelievably reckless and precarious mission to get in behind Vicksburg. And they get trapped. Rebels start cutting trees down in front of the boats and behind the boats. They trap the boats deep in the swamp. They attack. And at that point, Porter is miles ahead of Grant, who's coming, Sherman, who's trying to move through on troop ships that can't get through because they try to blast through the overhanging trees, knock off their chimneys, and so they have to march, and they're behind him. And Porter sends a message through a black plague that offers to cooperate. The Germans had get here, they're about to attack. He tells his crew, Porter does, that we're going to be boarded by these guys. They're going to come on board. It's going to be hand-to-hand combat. And we're going to probably lose. We're outnumbered. And in that case, we're going to blow up the boats and escape into the swamp and see if we can find our way back to Vicksburg. Well, nobody expected to live till the next day. But it's like an old hokey Western. I mean, Sherman gets there just in the nick of time on a borrowed horse and rides up to Porter, who has just had three naval officers shot within 2 feet of him. And this is a Confederate. They're ready to move. And he scatters the Confederate army, and they back out of the swamps. They don't have enough room. The embankments are high and streams narrow. They don't have enough room to turn the boats around, so they back out. And that ended the swamp expedition. Grant does what is, I think, one of the most audacious moves of the war. He talks to Porter, and Porter agrees to try to run his gunboats along with transports that would carry supplies past the Vicksburg batteries. And at the same time, this is really serendipitous. The waters in Louisiana start to recede. And you can see the tops of buildings and towns that have been submerged. And Grant gets word of this. It ain't clear at all. But it's going to be rough to get through these still flooded areas, but the flood waters aren't as high. That hadn't happened. He was sitting around kind of like Noah waiting for the waters to recede, and they do. And it's just at this point when he's backing out of the swamps that he's under tremendous pressure from the north. There's pressure from in Congress to remove him from his command, he and Sherman, and perhaps Porter. Lincoln's writing him this letter, stay out of the swamps. Lincoln's losing confidence in him. Lincoln sends a spy down from the Defense Department, Charles Dana, to spy on Grant Camp. The idea that he's there to undertake another mission for the War Department. This is the point where Vicksburg could have been lost and Grant would have receded into history as a non-entity, really. Yes, he was the first hero of the war, but his star would have been eclipsed quickly. But at just this moment, they get through the batteries, take actually minor damage, and Grant marches his army, takes an entire month through Louisiana, and first day of April they cross the Mississippi. They cross in the Mississippi River into the state of Mississippi. And that's the largest amphibious invasion by an American force in North America up till D-Day at Normandy. And then he marches on Vicksburg. So it's a hell of a story. And it's a story of a guy who has just dogged persistence and determination. Yeah, and who really refused to accept defeat. And another admirable characteristic of Grant. Everybody's despairing around him or criticizing him. And, again, stories go around. It's time just before the march that he's drinking again, and that's probably the problem. And maybe he ain't the man to take Vicksburg. And Lincoln stood by, because he was the only guy up to this point that was winning battles up west, and in fact he hadn't lost any, but he was about to lose Vicksburg, and he turns it around.
So the last section of the book, you talk about the actual fight for Vicksburg, the siege, and then the victory. I think this part just shows how many different factors played a role in the victory, from Johnson and his apparent unwillingness to fight, Pemberton and his inability to make decisions. What do you think was the most important factor in the victory?
Well, he helped General Pemberton out. John Pemberton, I don't think was the man to hold Vicksburg, and he wasn't a great commander. And it wasn't like fighting Robert E. Lee. But they had other good commanders, and when he was in a tough position when he went into Mississippi, when Grant went into Mississippi, because he lands in a place where there's no good maps. He has to depend on slaves as guides. Excuse me. And African-American slaves play a key part in the campaign, providing intelligence information to Grant on every aspect of, the terrain, rebel supplies, around the rebel army, things like that. So Grant, is actually, when he lands, he's between two armies. He's got an army in Vicksburg, almost as big as his. And he's got an army, a relief army, that's forming out to the east in the capital of Mississippi, which is Jackson. And don't forget, Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, was from Mississippi. He and his brother had sprawling plantations just below Vicksburg. In fact, Grant would later take over these plantations and turn them into slave freedmen's communities for freed blacks, and turn it into what he called, what he hoped would come, and he used this word, a Negro paradise. So the Davises, this is their state, and Davis is alarmed, and he's sending what reinforcements he has. The Confederacy has a manpower crisis, but he sends what he can under Joseph Johnston. And as I said, Grant respected Johnston, so he's between two armies. He could have easily lost this thing, but he does a smart thing. He doesn't go directly north and try to hit Vicksburg. He landed along the shoreline, 50 miles south of Vicksburg. But he takes the railroad that runs from Vicksburg to Jackson, and he cuts off Edmonton's supply line. He severs the supply line. And then he decides he's going to fight these guys in detail one time. And he wants to draw out Pemberton from the defenses. He doesn't want to get in a situation where he has to take on the whole city. And they had good defenses on the land side as well as the water side. He doesn't want a siege situation. He got one, but he didn't want one. And so he wants to draw out him. And he decides he also has to take out Johnson because he doesn't want to pump in his rear. So in less than a month, he tears through Mississippi. He takes a small town called Fort Gibson. He fights a battle, and then he decides to go to Jackson and Johnson. He fights a small battle on the way. Then he defeats Johnson in a brief engagement at Jackson and sends him scurrying to another part of the state. Now he's got nobody in his rear for the time being. Then he turns on Pemberton, and he defeats him. In one of the great battles of the Civil War, a place called Champion Hill, is a cotton estate, a cotton plantation, still owned by the Champion family, by the way. And Winston Churchill, in writing about U.S. history, said that this was the most important battle of the Civil War because he destroys the offensive capability of the Confederate Army. This is Grant later. In a sense, destroy the offensive capability of Robert E. Lee's army in Virginia. And then he drives the Confederates back inside the city and expects to take the city rather easily. The Confederate army is dispirited, morale is way down. They've taken staggering losses at Champion Hill. Champion Hill was only a one-day fight, but it was brutal. And the Confederates had unsustainable casualties. So he does the things he was criticized for. He decides his men, when they arrive at Vicksburg, wake up the next morning and see that that Vicksburg has these very powerful, formidable entrenchments and forts that protect the city. This long, long semicircular defense line around the city with rifle pits and artillery emplacements. And it's frightening. And Grant's army's tired. You know, they've been on the march most of the time without ration and for long periods of time. And so Grant, you know, decides to attack the federal line, the Union, the Confederate line. And he takes staggering losses in both of these assaults. And he decides that rather than lose more men attacking almost invincible fortifications, he goes into a siege situation and 47 day siege. And he starves them out. And it's not a passive siege, Ken. It's an aggressive siege where they're digging toward Vicksburg underground, creating mines. One of them blew up a Vicksburg fort. They're digging entrenchments to set up rifle pits closer and closer to the Confederates. By the end of June, I mean, they were within spitting distance. You could almost, of the Confederate lines, you could throw a stone and hit a Confederate. And at that point, you know, it's pretty much over for Vicksburg, because what they're counting on is that Joseph Johnson Jackson, who comes back to Jackson and refits an army, gets the reinforcements, and those were the reinforcements that Grant was so scared of when he went to Sparta. And Grant fears, they'll attack his rear, so he sets up a line of a defense line behind his siege line, and that's commanded by Sherman, waiting for Johnson to attack. And so were the people of Vicksburg waiting, and they waited in vain. Johnson never showed up. He got close. He surveyed Grant's position, thought it was too powerful to challenge, and rode back to his camp. And that's where he was in the Jackson area when Vicksburg surrenders. But I try to go inside the city and tell what it was like, the horrors of being in a besieged city as being constantly bombarded. Now, you don't hear much about killing civilians in the Civil War. And a lot of historians say, well, this is why the Civil War wasn't a total war, like World War II. I know a lot about bombing. You know, I did a book on it, an entire book on it, Masters of the Air. And a lot of that book concerns how people hold up under bombing. I was very influenced when I was writing the book by Aleppo and places like that, Syria, and the horrors of women and children, innocent people, under the bombs. How do they hold up? The British supposedly held up very well in World War II. I did a lot of investigation on that and found out that, well, not so much. We were in an area of very intense bombing. Morale, you know, plummeted. And Britain had been bombed as heavily as Germany. Their morale would have went down to the basement. And using what I knew about bombing and working with diaries, Southern women, and these women inside Vicksburg, a lot of them wrote compelling, actually beautifully written and very evocative diaries of what it was like. And they lived, for the most part, in caves. Caves that were dug into the soft soil of the Hill City. And sometimes they'd live in their house during the day. When the bombing started at night, they'd race to the caves. And the bombs were huge. I mean, they're bombing Vicksburg from Grant's army is on the east side of the city, on the west, on the river. Porter's taken over the river. It's the Yankee River now. And he's bombarding it with his gunboat. And he also brings up these mortar schooners, which had to tow up the river. And they're enormous. And they have shells that are, you know, that weigh up to 100 pounds. And they have, you know, you shoot them high in the sky. It looks like a fireworks display with a fuse going off. And then they land with tremendous impact. Luckily, a lot of civilians were killed because these things took a while. You could see them and you could race to your cave. But the terror of being under that, you know, bombardment, really they're inside a circle of fire, was harrowing. And so I deal with how Vicksburg, and the city's also running out of provisions. One of the things Grant did is, and this is an ironic situation. The ironic situation is that the longer Vicksburg held out, the worse things got for it. Because there's no, all the army, all the Confederate army is inside the city. You know, they're back in Jackson. And so Grant's army is free to go anywhere they want. They raided plantations all over Mississippi. And they sold cattle, sheep. They broke into storehouses. They destroyed cotton supplies, burned barns, burned plantations, smoked certain pots, and turned most of Mississippi into a blackened wasteland. And that's a story that's not told too often in military history. And that's where my history, I think, becomes, from my background, I'm primarily a social and intellectual historian. It became a historian of ideas. I was able to get into the social situation around Vicksburg and how families held up or didn't hold up under the bombardment and under the incessant pressure of the siege, knowing that there was no help available except this long-range hope that maybe Johnson could, you know, relieve the siege by attacking Grant from the rear. So women play a big part in my story, and slaves do too, not just those scouts. But see, when you're out there raiding these plantations, Lincoln and Grant agree that they have to begin to war on civilians, not just by bombardment, but war on their property, and by stealing everything they can, by destroying crops in the field, and by stealing slaves, and then turning those slaves, bringing those slaves back into their camps and using them as laborers, not when they're behind Union lines, in the terms of the Emancipation Proclamation and earlier legislation. And Grant frees, in liberating Vicksburg, he liberates over 100,000 slaves. You know, when this thing was all over, African Americans in the vicinity considered Grant the great liberator, not Lincoln. He's the man who freed them. And Frederick Douglass made that point. And I have a little epigraph in my novel, a quote from Frederick Douglass, where he points out that Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, but the only one, but that doesn't free any slaves in the North. It frees only slaves in the South. But how can you free them if they're controlled by Southern plantation owners? You'd have to go in. The Emancipation Proclamation only makes sense if Grant shows up on your front lawn and you're a slave owner and starts stealing your slaves. And that's the word Southerners use for stealing the slaves. Grant's talking about his liberation, which it was. And so I get into that. And I get into the history of the inarticulate, if you will, you know, from people who don't write a lot of diaries, but left oral testimonies that I use, and describe how slaves, actually, it's inaccurate to say that the Union freed the slaves, because so many slaves freed themselves. Just the presence of the army put them into a predicament, but a predicament that was held out a measure of hope. Because if you could escape and you could get to Grant's army, and that meant, you know, you had Southern patrols, you had ferocious, you know, dogs that could catch the scent of the slaves. It's very difficult. And maybe you didn't know a lot about the terrain and things like that. But the gutsy decision to try to break away to Grant's army, and even those slaves who didn't break away, they became different people. And we have this from the diaries of Northerners. That's why the Northern diaries are so terrific. You know, I did 51 archives for this thing from California to New York, and I found amazing archival material. Again, diaries written mostly by plantation mistresses who were left alone in many cases. Their men are all fighting the war, their boys and their husbands. And it's just granddad and baby and the mistress and an overseer and maybe 200 slaves. How do you control those slaves? Especially when Grant's army's in the vicinity. So So a lot of slaves would approach the plantation mistress and demand, not ask, for certain so-called rights. They're not going to answer the door anymore. They're not going to do the cleaning. They'll just do the cooking. You got to provide pay, and or they're going to leave. And there's these negotiations that go on. I wanted to find out, and I think I did find out, and I tell the readers the story of how slaves were actually freed. Not just saying, oh, the proclamation or the army did it, but how it was done, household to household. So the book becomes, you know, a social history of the Confederacy under siege, under attack, and its response. And you know, it's actually, you get, if I can reel back just a second, when Grant first invaded Mississippi in late 1862 and had to retreat, when he retreated, and even going in, his armies, he lost control of his kids, of the kids in the army. They were angry. It's like Vietnam. They didn't want to be there. They didn't know the terrain. They didn't like the people. And they saw that slaves were helping the Confederates, and that released men from farm work and to fight. And their farmers themselves and their families are in tough situations because, in many cases, that soldier is the only provider. And the war is keeping him away from his children and keeping away from supporting his family. So they're not happy, and they have a sour relationship with Southerners, and it turns ugly. They start entering homes, which they're not supposed to do. Pull the earrings out of the ears of Southern women. Invade their bedrooms. It wasn't a lot of rape. There were rapes, but it's hard to document. There were undoubtedly hundreds of thousands more than are recorded. But it's the intimidation and the destruction. And so, when I agree with Grant, the Confederates fought well in the war, but probably for the worst cause imaginable. But they had a point. When the Yankees were in the area, it was trouble for the family, possible endangerment of the wives and children. And so in their letters, they're referred to by men as well as women, Mississippians, as vandals and as Visigoths. And that's how they're seen, because largely what happened in northern Mississippi. See, what happens here is inside a civil war is occurring what Karl Marx at the time called a social revolution. He's writing for a Brooklyn newspaper. And it really was. It's a war. It's the first American social revolution where one class is trying to overturn a situation where they're at the bottom, the bottom rails, not on top, but, you know, it fights for its freedom. And the American Revolution is a political revolution. Independence. It's a movement to crush independence by the North, Southern Secession, but it's also a movement by Grant's army and other armies eventually to free an underclass, and with the help of that underclass. And so it is a social revolution, and it starts in Mississippi. And I think that's missed, largely, as is Grant's role as liberators in most histories, almost all histories of Vicksburg. And that takes me to, like, the first question to ask when I write the book. I really saw that this story had to be told. The story of liberation had to be worked into the story of an effort to crush secession.
Yeah. And at the end of the book, you mentioned that you started work on it back in 1997. And that you visited a lot of the locations that were central to Grant's campaign. So how do you think that makes your book different from other books on Vicksburg?
Well, I don't know if it sets it off that way, I think being new to the project, not having done military history, in the end, it was difficult, but I had to learn so much. But it gave me I hope, a fresh perspective on things. And I could cast a cold eye on things, and I wasn't just working off other people's books. I wanted to see it anew. And I'll tell you an interesting story. It's a funny story. When I was down there, and I'm just starting out, I'm thinking of doing the Vicksburg book. I'm almost sure I'm going to do it. And I ran into an historian named Ed Barrs. Now, Ed's still walking the earth, and he's in his 90s, and he's a Pacific War veteran, a great guy, and a good historian. And he used to run the military park down there, eventually the whole military park service. And Ed's a legend, and among historians, and he's a legendary guide, known to tens of thousands of Pacific War veterans. Terrific guy. So I ran into Ed. I had never met him before, and we spent two days together. And he took me toward the battlefield, and second night, he said to me, "Miller, you're going to write the best book on Vicksburg." I said, "No, Ed." He said, "Because you don't know a damn thing about it." I said, "Well, that's true, but why is that?" He said, "Well, we're kind of, in the forest, and we're not seeing, we're seeing the trees, and you're outside, and you can see the big picture, and hopefully you can bring that big angle, wide angle view to the battle." And I was helped immensely by people like Ed Barrs and a guy named Warren Graybow, who was a geographer who eventually wrote a geographical history of Vicksburg, who walked me through the battlefield and reinforced my understanding of the importance of terrain. Battles aren't fought on pool tables, you would say. And then he went on to write this indispensable book about, the role that the land terrain played in Vicksburg. So I think that set me off. I'm a trespasser. I'm not a specialist. I've written books on New York. I've written books on Chicago. I've written books on the coal regions of Pennsylvania, where my relatives are from. I write a book based on my interest in it. I think, I'll be reading. I do a lot of reading, and it's like, maybe we need a book on this. And if I can't find it, I start thinking maybe I'll write about it. And I got a list of scores of books that I just never already started and never completed. A novel about Florence and 14th century and things like that. 18th century. But anyway, that's how I write. So you're going on to the territory. You're an historian. You know how this is. You're invading the territory, as it were, of specialists, and who are going to suspect you right away. But luckily, I ran into, as I did when I wrote my book on Chicago, tremendously helpful people. And Harry Winchell, who was the park historian down there, opened up the archives of Vicksburg for me and allowed me to work in his office on them. Everybody was helpful. People made me feel at home in Vicksburg. I still enjoy going down there. Gordon Cotton helped me. He's the head of the old courthouse museum, which is the museum on the city of Vicksburg, and a lot of great stuff on the battle. So people like that could be gave me shelter, fed me meals, drank beer with me, and writing the book was terrific. And traveling around to these libraries was great, making new finds. And that's primarily what the book is based on. Primary source material. I always say that there might be better historians. I don't know, there undoubtedly are, sure. But nobody's going to out-research me. And so I exhaustively researched that book. And I walked every battlefield that Grant fought on, in the West as well as the East. I wanted to create in the book what I always try to create. It's a sense of place. I want you to know where this character is and what the place looked like, how it felt like, what the weather was like. Hemingway writes that the weather, tell the readers about the weather, he says. Weather is always so important and will play a big part in the action of the characters. And I read a lot of fiction and I try to use the tools of a novelist. I like Shelby Foote does, and Shelby Foote was a good novelist. And fiction's about narration, It has color, incident, excitement, tension, contingency. And I try to bring all of those things into my history and tell the story, not from hindsight, but hindsight can often distort. Sure, I'm writing after the fact. It makes me a phony about hindsight, but wait a minute. If you have the diaries of people who are making decisions day to day, you understand how they felt when they made the decision. Because when they made the decision, they had no idea. But Grant's making a battlefield decision. When a family's trying to decide whether to get out of the way of Grant's army or not, they don't know what's going to happen the next day, just as you and I don't know what's going to happen the next minute. And you have to see it from their perspective at the point they make the decision. And then you have a verisimilitude. Then you have a sense of how people, you get into motivation and why they did things. And you understand that they make them in the context of their times. You're not censorious, you know, writing from the 20th century or 21st century perspective. So I write narrative history, but I try to bring interpretation into it. And want the reader, I always put a thing over my desk, will the reader turn the next page? And it's a Barbara Tuchman idea, great story. And moving the story along and giving it fidelity, that is, making it as close to how it was as you can get using the sources, which are always limited. You always have limitations. But you do try, and that takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time. It took me a lot of time to write the book.
Well, it definitely shows in the heft of it, but you've definitely got a page turner here.
Yeah. I can't write short books. I've written a couple, but you know, my editor's always, one of my readers, actually a friend of mine, said, "Don, how about a 300-page book, huh?" And well, I've written a couple, but this, when we did get to a point where, like, I said to my editor, it was a tough editor, but we've been together since 95. I love him, Bob Bender. You know, Bob wants the story as tight as possible, but he couldn't find any ways to cut the thing. At the very end, I did cut. I have this number posted over my desk, 29,380 words. That's in addition to the cuts that I made as I was going along.
Right.
I mean, a lot of books are that long, so I got that material out of there. So, you know, I don't think there's anything extraneous in it.
No, definitely
and,
not.
You know, so far it's not boring anybody that I know. Of course, they're not going to tell me.
So,
it was fun. It was fun to do, and now that I'm on the road promoting the book, and you know, I'm getting some recognition and a prize here and there. I mean, it's helping. And to make me see, you know, actually, without inflating myself here, it made me see the importance of what I've done in taking a Civil War iconic battle and giving it, you know, a new twist. Telling it in a different way.
Definitely. You're definitely placing Vicksburg at the forefront, which I think it deserves to be.
It's huge. And I didn't say what I should say here, you know, as we end this, but hey, why did it break the Confederacy? Well, look, it was a mortal blow to morale all over the Confederacy, and maybe we can't win in the West. The whole Mississippi becomes the Yankee River, and that's hugely important, not just to the farmers of the Midwest, but for military operations. And New Orleans open as a port to the sea. Sure, it was liberated before, but what good did it do if you couldn't reach it from the north? It split the Confederacy in half. Not quite in half, but it split it. And western Louisiana and Arkansas and Texas, they're out of the war. And very difficult to communicate with the rest of the Confederacy. And supplies like salt, smuggled in rifles from Galveston that came through the blockade, and molasses, which is often used as a form of currency. A lot of those supplies are diminished or, you know, dried up by the Union occupation of the river. But Grant captures also, for the second time in the war, an entire army. The army of Vicksburg, over 30,000 guys. Takes that out of the war. Takes Mississippi out of the war. It's done in Mississippi. Takes most of Tennessee, western Tennessee, out of the war. Takes all the river counties in northern Louisiana out of the war. But it frees 100,000 slaves. And more. But maybe the most important thing, and I think, I would say perhaps, because a little stronger than maybe, and even surely. What Grant did in Vicksburg was he found a way to beat the South, and nobody has figured it out. It wasn't going to be by individual battles. Antietam, then Long Lull, and before that, and after that, Gettysburg, and then, of course, the Richmond battles and the Overland March and things. Fights, and then going to winter camp, Long Lulls between the battles. Grant fought relentlessly at Vicksburg. And he didn't think of it as a battle just against Vicksburg. And that's where we started this tale today. It's a campaign. It's like the campaign the United States engaged in World War II when it landed in Normandy. Not just to take Normandy and liberate Paris, but to go all the way or as close as possible to Berlin. And all the smaller battles along the way. And they were big battles as well. Herkin Forest, and Old. They're all part of this overall campaign. And that's how Grant saw things. And just like the armies were these campaigns are coordinated and they're worked out in cooperation with Navy and Army as well. Grant wanted all armies in the country to operate in concert. And just as he worked with Port at Vicksburg. So when he goes to fight Lee, he becomes commander-in-chief of all the Union armies. And all the offenses, all the assaults, all the battles are integrated. They're all part of a bigger plan. And all the armies work in concert. And war is unrelenting. And war is also vicious. It is fought with tremendous determination. And it's fought against, in the East as well, against citizen property. Think of Phil Sheridan, who went into the Shenandoah Valley and Grant Bullitt, who went in there, which is a breadbasket that fed Richmond, and turned it into a waste. And he did. And that's the way he fought around Vicksburg. Unfortunately, as he and Sherman agreed, this is the only way. When you're fighting your people, it's determined to the very end, at least for the leadership. To hold on to their independence and to hold on to their slaves. Sherman put it bluntly, you have to kill them. And Grant didn't put it that way, but he did say that you had to destroy every Southern army. And what these armies depended upon for survival, food and stock for animals. And so it's just a war on supply as well as on people. And that's how the Confederacy was brought down. And Grant introduced that style of fighting because he was brought back to Washington just after Vicksburg. And Sherman took it into Georgia. Sherman Sherman isn't the originator of the hard war, the total war, the way it was fought in Georgia. He learned to fight under Grant. He had objections to the way Grant fought at first in Vicksburg. He thought that if you allow the troops to rampage and pillage, it'll break down discipline in the army. Sherman was a proponent of order. And rightly so. When an army's on the move and marching and invading, it has to maintain its integrity and its order. So he has these reservations. And when Grant, for example, at one point in the campaign, sends a commander who served under Grant into the Yazoo Delta and told him to destroy everything he came across. except not to enter the private homes of people. That was always, you know, Grant always insisted on that. It was hard to enforce, though. But when he did that, Sherman was taken aback and thought it was being cruel. And so Sherman learns to fight under Grant. Grant he's the man of steel, not so much Sherman.
Well, Donald,
that's the big outtake. I mean, from Vicksburg on, the Confederacy could not win the battle on the battlefield. And by battlefield victories, they could win by not losing. Holding on, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong did, holding on and bleeding the North, taking casualties, delivering casualties, delivering hurt, and to such a point where the home front said, enough, the cause isn't worth fighting for. But Lincoln, to the very end, held tight to that cause, and when he was under tremendous pressure to give up on abolition and let the South come back into the Union with slaves. But he didn't. You know, he had some negotiations, secret negotiations, the Southern so-called peace talks. But in the negotiation, one thing was, and Grant agreed with him, that was unalterable. You're going to come back into the Union. There's going to be a separate Confederacy. Lincoln never accepted the Confederacy as a separate country. Grant never did either. And they're going to have to come back without slaves if they come back. So they held to that. And that's, again, that partnership between Grant and Lincoln starts out in Pittsburgh. And Grant begins to see that this is the way to win. And Lincoln sees it as well.
Well, I think we've taken up a lot of your time here, Donald. So we like to close out each of these interviews by asking what projects you have lined up next. I think earlier you mentioned that you're working on a next book.
Yes. Yeah, this is going to be a book about, there's been a lot of books about James Jefferson. He's written a beautiful book about Grant as commander-in-chief. Excuse me, Lincoln as commander-in-chief. There hasn't been a book about Grant as commander-in-chief. About Eisenhower as Supreme Commander in Europe, and not about Grant as Commander-in-Chief, just as a battlefield chief. But from a small little community, a plantation really, called City Point in Virginia, in the Virginia Peninsula where the Revolution was concluded, from a little spot, living in a tent and then a two-room cabin, Grant directed the entire war, and he did it in partnership with the president. And so while he's fighting Lee, he's directing Sherman's operations in Georgia, General George Thomas's operations in Tennessee, and he's directing the cavalry under Sheridan, and he's directing armies that are trying to take Mobile, and he's cooperating with the Navy to close the ports that the Confederate is using to run blockade runners. So it's a fascinating story. Lincoln's in the White House under all this pressure, and Grant's down there under all that pressure. He's besieging a little town called Petersburg, which is below Richmond, and he's besieging Richmond itself. He can't break through. It's a longer siege, a far longer siege, almost 10 months, than Vicksburg. And if he doesn't win, if he doesn't take Petersburg and Richmond and defeat Lee, if he doesn't make inroads, if Sherman is stopped, if Thomas, you know, can't destroy Confederate armies in Tennessee, Lincoln loses the election in 1864. And if Lincoln loses the election, McClellan, his opponent, gets it, and McClellan was willing to negotiate with the South. And the Democratic Party was filled with what were called copperheads who were willing to have the South come in and back in with slaves. So it would have been a different country. But Grant had secured enough battlefield victories with his armies, Sherman taking Atlanta, Sheridan making inroads and destroying the economic structure of the whole economy, really, of the valley. These victories, Farragut at Mobile Bay, won Lincoln the election. So a lot's at stake in this relationship. So I'm going to get into that, that little part of the war that's turned out to be a pretty big part of the war. Yeah. I've already started it. I've researched. I'm in the embryonic stages that I was going to take a long break, play some golf and all that. I did a little of that, but now I'm back on the treadmill. Back at it. Yeah. But I like it.
Well, that sounds interesting, and we look forward to reading that one eventually when you're finished.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate all your big questions. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and we look forward to your next book.
Fantastic.